That's the coolest hold music I've ever heard. I'm waiting for Sir Jackie Stewart. You're listening to In the Garage Podcast. The wind from the southwest at 5 miles an hour. 16 at TPC Sawgrass. Playing a bit soft this weekend. A tradition like no other.
Hello, it's Jackie Stewart.
Sir Jackie and Jim O'Brien, In the Garage Podcast here in Detroit, Michigan. It's an honor. How are you, sir?
I'm very well indeed, thank you very much. I called you from the States the other day. I was up in America.
I think
you were fast asleep.
My apologies for that. I wanted to ask you something as straight away. How is Helen?
Well, not so well. I mean, dementia's one of these things that sadly don't get better. It's a bit of a struggle for her and for everybody else for that matter, but that's the story of dementia. So we're busy trying to change things on that. I started a charity called Race Against Dementia.
Yes.
Because I really want to find, more than anything else, preventive medicine, not just corrective. So it's a fairly big project in my little world at the present time. So, She's fine, but at the same time, she's pretty, you know, she's far from being herself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's raceagainstdementia.com is the website. You guys did a really good job. And there's a couple things, Jackie, that you've said in the past when it comes to this. And not only is this forefront from talking to you, I had the opportunity to spend some time with some veterans here in the Motor City over the weekend. And I met a gentleman who was in the early stages of dementia. And you could just tell the way he's wrestling with his memories and trying to just hold on to what he's got. And it's just, it's a very raw feeling. That was the word I took away when I, after spending time with William, that he's just trying to hold on to what's there. And it's tough. And it's tough for everybody around him, too.
Oh, yeah. It's a new part of life altogether. It's a new generation. And if he's only got it in the short-term memory type thing at the present time, that gets worse and worse, but the physical gets worse and worse as well. And then they can't recognize people or remember people or even where they are. So it's a pretty bad disease to have.
Well, you said no problems. John Lennon said it best, no problems, only solutions. I love that mindset. And your attitude throughout your career, Jackie, has always been one that you just find a way to make it work. So you seem to be the sort of person, you get motivated.
That's what we're going to do on this one. I mean, we've got some terrific people and, you know, I'm all over the world on it. So I'm pretty certain we're going to find the situation, but the brain's a rather difficult piece of kit.
Yeah.
Quite complicated, but we'll find it. We've got to find it. That's for sure. For 20 years, they haven't found it and they've spent billions and just haven't done a good enough job. So it's only going to come from young people. It's not going to be the mature ones that are going to do it now. They know what they've failed in the past, but the young ones are going to be the ones that are going to do it for the future.
Well, that was kind of your mindset, if you think about it, with safety in Formula One, that you had the track owners and you know, the they didn't want to make changes. They didn't need to. They had huge crowds and everybody was happy, but it was you and some of your other drivers were the ones that the younger drivers said, I don't want to drive like this with this level of danger.
Well, times change, and the establishment in anything, whether it's in motorsports, whether it's in medicine, whether it's in banking, whether it's in any industry at all, and then there's new industries that come along that waken everybody. I mean, look at websites today, look at the internet. So people have changed, and in my particular case, motor racing hadn't changed since the end of World War II, which is long before I ever started to race. But those same racetracks were being raced upon with little or no change to any of those racetracks. And therefore, the people who were running it, if it was good enough for Fangio and Ascari and Villaresi and Taruffi and Farina, why is it not good enough for Jim Clark or Jackie Stewart or Graham Hill or Dan Gurney or Jack Brabham? So there was an ignorance there, if you like, or an unawareness would be a kind way to put it. So therefore, suddenly in 1966 particularly, we went from a 1.5-litre engine to a 3-litre engine. And that's to say from 1,500 cc's to 3,000 cc's, twice the size and therefore the power of the cars that were racing on the very same racetracks. So our cornering speeds were higher, our entry to each corner was higher, and yet there was no more, there wasn't any further runoff area. So therefore the number of fatalities we started to get at that time, nobody wanted to change anything. If it's, you know, if the kitchen's too hot, why don't you get out of it? That was the general opinion. So it was a cultural change, but it was a change that had to happen at the right time, and I just happened to be the person that was around at that time.
And it's, Jackie, I think as fans, when we would watch, you know, when I look at the most, some of the most beautiful tracks in the world, and then I step back and realize Spa to me is one of the most beautiful tracks I've ever seen. I love watching it on television, but as a driver, that had to be one of the most dangerous circuits in the world to drive on, especially with, like you said, the F1 cars with that much power.
Well, today, Spa is relatively safe, actually. The runoff areas are better, the deformable structures, there's no just hardcore ignorance such as there were in those days, because you were going to go into a forest, you're going to go into trees, you were going to go into grass banks. Now you've got deformable structures that a racing car is much safer in itself, but the racetracks, when you hit something heavy, it's not a heavy impact. It's consumed. The impact's consumed properly at a speed that allows the brain still to stay alive. So all of these things had to be done. There was no question about that in my mind. And I was lucky enough to be winning world championships at that time. Had I not been winning world championships, I wouldn't have got half of what we got done, not even half. It was only the power of the media. If I were talking to you and it was, you know, turning the clock back, if I were telling you all of those things and your viewers, or rather your listeners, would be listening to that, it would be common sense that you would have to change. But the establishment, the old brigade, wouldn't have wanted to change anything. But that still happens in today. There's a lot of things today happening that the younger generation are coming along and changing the packages. I mean, finding new ways of doing business. So, I mean, it was horrendous, the number of people we were losing. One year we lost 4 drivers in 4 consecutive months.
Wow.
The 7th of April, Jim Clark died. The 7th of March, 7th of April and May, Mike Spence died in the same weekend, the 7th. And then Ludovico Scafiotti died in the same weekend in June. And then Joe Schlesser died in the weekend of the 5th and 6th of July. You know, 4 top-line drivers, Grand Prix drivers, died in 4 consecutive months for no good reason. They couldn't put the fires out. They couldn't recover the driver. The driver was so badly injured, and in the case of Jim Clark, going into a wood, you know, a forest.
Right.
And the car just disintegrated around him. You know, the gearbox wasn't there. They separated from the engine, and the engine was separated from the chassis. I mean, the violence on hitting full-size trees at high speed was just ridiculous, and it should never, there was no protection. There was nothing between the racetrack and the forest. The same was at the Nürburgring.
Right.
The old Nürburgring, 187 corners per lap, 14.7 miles for each lap, and you couldn't marshal it. You know, both sides of the road, 14.7 miles, that's more than 29 miles. You've got to have marshals, firefighters, you know, people to get the right equipment to get a driver out of a car, even to clear the track. They didn't have enough people. So we had to close that, and that was a scandal, me closing the Nürburgring, or the Grand Prix Drivers Association, of which I was president, closing a track like that, and we closed Spa. for the same reasons. There was just no protection anywhere. I got trapped in a car in Spa for over 30 minutes with the fuel all around me because the fuel tank had burst internally, and it's a monocoque chassis, so it was sitting in a bathtub of high-octane fuel. And they couldn't get me out because the steering wheel in those days was not a removable steering wheel. And they had to, there was no marshals, no medical help. Graham Hill and Bob Bondurant, an American, had to borrow wrenches from spectators' cars to get me out of the car.
Is it true, Jackie, at one point that the drivers, you actually put spanners, you taped them to your steering wheel for things like that?
The very next race I raced in, there was a spanner on the steering wheel. Because they didn't have removable steering wheels then. Now, of course, they've got removable steering wheels. And it wasn't long after that time we did get memorial steering wheels, but it took a long time. But looking back on it now, it sounds ridiculous, but at the time, the establishment had been racing, and if it was good enough for them, why is it not good enough for you young fellas? So we had to change the rules, and luckily we got it done. And, you know, Formula One Grand Prix racing now, we went 21 years without taking the life of a Formula One driver.
Well, it's worked. I mean, and we see the results now with F1 and, you know, the Liberty Media taking over the sport now. And hopefully I wouldn't say the rebirth, but maybe more forefront here in the United States. And Time Magazine, I just got that article about Lewis Hamilton. And I wanted to ask you a question, Jackie. I don't want to talk about Nico and them right now, but I do want to talk about driving styles, because I thought it was interesting that he said from an early age he figured out how to drive in deeper to a corner than anybody else and brake later. And you always strike me as just the smoothest driver on the track. You make it look so easy the way you treat your car, and it always feels like Lewis is the guy who's just going to beat the heck out of his car and push it as hard as he can. And maybe that was part of the problem last season when he had the three, you know, DNFs breaking the car down. Do you see a difference in style between the two of you?
Oh, yes, a big difference. But, of course, there's a big difference between the cars now as well. The structure of the car is different. The rigidity of the car is different. The ceramic brake discs are different. You can brake much, much later. However, the really good guys can do it still with millisecond ability. Where I was dealing, let's call it, in seconds, they're now dealing in milliseconds. But it doesn't change anything because your mind also accelerates. So you're synchronizing your brain to the same requirements as I would have been, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago or 40 years ago. So you can still do that. It's the same as saying a propeller-driven fighter plane is different than a full F-19 or F-18 or whatever the
sure.
top fighter plane is today in your country. It would be a lot different than a Mustang that was a fighter plane in a certain period of time.
P-51,
The pilot changes to deal with the different speeds, the different G-forces. He adjusts to all of that. It's not that he's a better pilot than the Mustang pilot of let's call it the 40s, 30s and 40s and 50s. They've adjusted sufficiently well that they can do that, and they're still Top Gun guys. And of the Top Gun guys, there'll only be a very few of them that are absolutely on top of it.
So would your driving style be different today because of the cars, the way they're set up, and the like you said, the build of them?
Yeah, sure. I would have to adjust to that, but I would still have to know that I could, in the milliseconds difference that there is today, I would have to do it differently. But I would have to accelerate my abilities to the same acceleration of technology that's taken place in the modern car. So it's not magic. It's absolutely common sense. And some of the people that are doing it still to this day are pushing too hard, braking too fast, accelerating too fast, turning in too fast, turning out too fast. All of these things, your head goes into slow motion, and you're able to feel a car at even the shortest windows of time. You can still adjust to that, because my driving style followed the style of Fangio, and he was driving a much slower corner speed car than I ever was. Jim Clark came before me, and I carried the same type of... I mean, I learned more from Jim Clark than anybody else. I idolized Fangio because I saw how easily he could drive a racing car without upsetting the racing car. Now, I drove my racing cars during my window of time in that same basis. So therefore, there are some drivers who are totally capable. Alain Prost, for example, was one of the smoothest, cleanest drivers. So there's always one or two that are able to do that. The Mercedes-Benz right now, whether it's Lewis or whether it was Nico, that car was so good in the last 3 years that, in fact, probably a minimum of six drivers on the Grand Prix grid could have won in that car. So therefore, it's a little different when the car has been having that amount of superiority. Their engine and the car was just ahead of everybody else, particularly the engine. So I think there's windows of time where the machine helps the driver perhaps a little too much. But on the other hand, the really great drivers in the world are the ones who can do it consistently and stay out of trouble and don't get too many incidents. Fortunately, today, people have accidents and they have survivals. Look at Alonso's survival this year.
Yeah.
Huge accident he had. He walked away from the car. No way would that have occurred in a previous generation.
Do you, when you look at Nico Rosberg, and I know you've used the word courageous, and I do too, for a man to know, okay, I've done what I wanted to do, and the stress of this, I'm done. Was there ever a point, Jackie, where you were along that path like Nico Rosberg, where you're like, I just don't want to do this anymore?
Yes, but it started off for me 3 years, actually. I nearly retired at the end of 1971, a long time ago, because that year I won the world championship, but I was working for ABC's Wide World of Sports. I was working for Goodyear. I was working for a whole lot of different companies, as well as driving Can-Am, as well as driving touring cars, that's sedan cars in your language, sports cars, GT cars, and Formula 2 cars. I was doing something like 53 races in 26 different racing cars. And that year I crossed the Atlantic, 86 times.
Really?
During the season. And I did win the world championship. I finished second, I think, in the Can-Am. And I was just completely destroyed at the end of the season. I got mononucleosis, which is a blood disorder. And I was so ill, I never even went to pick up my world championship that year. My wife Helen did it for me. The following year, I won the world championship. That was 71, with all that nonsense going on. In 72, I had a duodenal ulcer that hemorrhaged. And that was part of the previous year's illness, I think. So I missed a few races, and I didn't win the world championship that year. I finished second, and then I won it. And I nearly retired, by the way, when I was having the ulcer problem, because it was bleeding internally. But I decided at the end of the season, my health was back. And I thought, well, I'll do another year. So 73 was my last year. And I made my decision in April that I was going to retire at the end of the year because I didn't want to let Ken Tyrrell down, because we went on to win the world championship that year because the car was competitive and I had a great teammate in François Sever who sadly was killed in what would have been my last Grand Prix.
Watkins Glen, yeah.
It was, know, I knew I was going to retire, but I was totally satisfied that there wasn't going to be a return of Jackie Stewart driving racing cars. It was going to be a single retirement.
I was watching the Weekend of the Champion, the documentary with you at Monaco, Jackie, and there was a scene with you and Francois. You're talking strategy. I think you're talking about changing second gear, making it a little bit shorter, a little bit taller, and you're talking about one of the turns. And suddenly you grabbed him on the shoulder and you said, "Nope." And I don't know that they showed us who was eavesdropping on you, but was another team just kind of listening in?
No, it was a journalist, actually. It was a man called Helmut Spiegel. I know who it was. I think I said, Helmut, you're listening to all my secrets. I mean, nowadays, telemetry is everything. You know, in my day, there was more communication between the engineers. You had to paint a colorful picture of how the car was behaving in certain other parts of the racetrack and how it was either braking or turning in or whether you wanted more Ackerman or more brakes front or rear or different. We didn't have much in the way of aerodynamics. There were by then aerodynamics, but it wasn't as sophisticated as it is today. But there were certainly no sensoring devices. Now there are over 200 sensors on a Formula One car. So sometimes the mechanics will know what's gone wrong before the driver ever feels it. That's progress. But hey, in the days of the great Fangio, for example, it was the highest technology in the world at that time, as it was for Stirling Moss or Jim Clark or Jackie Stewart or Alan Prost or Ayrton Senna or any of these drivers. It's always been the same. All you can do is be the best of your time.
And you were. And that's one thing. But I was going to, Jackie, were there people that were there teams and stuff that were trying to maybe glean? The NASCAR references, Suitcase Jake Elder. I always remember the stories how he would roll from car to car underneath looking to see what they would do until somebody caught him. And then he would just go, "Oh, my bad." And he'd go back to his pit. And I wondered in F1 during that time, were there people that were trying to just figure out what you guys were doing?
Yeah, I think that's pretty natural. Somebody's a bit surprised because in those days it was an easier count as well, as indeed it is in NASCAR, because in those days when I was driving my championship years, the Ford Cosworth engine was the engine. But I mean, in my day there would be probably 26, 28 racing cars on the grid, and out of those 26 or 28 there would be probably 20 of them were Ford engines, Ford Cosworth engine. And that was as regular as an engine could be. There was no works engine, so to speak. So there was much more to get out of driving the car in a different fashion, perhaps, because everybody had the same power to play with. Which is not always the same. You know, there's been a time when Ferrari have had a superior engine or Renault had it for a while, and Mercedes-Benz certainly has it as we speak. So in those days, the Cosworth was a fantastic leveler of driver skill because most of the top drivers were driving Cosworth engines. When I was racing, Ferrari engines never won the world championship, for example.
Never. You just always assume the prancing horse is always there. I mean, but you're right. There are periods in their history where they just weren't as competitive.
Correct. Wow. Yeah. So it was therefore very easy to answer your question. You were always looking for the advantage because you knew you weren't going to get it in power, so you had to have it in suspension or aerodynamics or tires or whatever. I mean, there was much more. There was a much more level playing field.
So, Sir Jackie Stewart is with us. I want to mention RaceAgainstDementia.com is the website he started for his wife Helen, and for everyone knows someone who's dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia, and it's so easy to donate. You can go on there, click a button, and it's definitely something to do this holiday season. I saw you here in Detroit at Belle Isle last year. I believe you were here. And What do you think about not only what we're seeing with IndyCar, but the rebirth of Belle Isle and Detroit as a whole for getting back to our racing roots?
Well, Detroit's still Motor City for me. You know, the great days of the American automobile industry, of whether it was Ford or General Motors or Chrysler, I mean, it's an amazing place. And there should be motor racing in Detroit. That was the capital of the world at one point of the motor car. And I think it's great. Roger Penske's done an immense amount to ensure that. And, of course, he's not only that, but a tremendous entrant in motorsport and has been for a great many years. So you've got some great Americans out there. We are lacking Americans. We want Americans into Formula One. It would be fantastic for us to have two or three. You know, when you think of Mario Andretti days and Dan Gurney days and Phil Hill before him, a lot of other Americans have tried it but not made the big time. But they certainly did. And we could very much deal with an American right now. It would be a great asset to Formula One if we could get a young American. But that young American has to get out of America. He can do what he likes to get to a certain level. Then he's got to come over to Europe. And this is where the hot racing really is. This is where they make you and you break you. That's why when they come from Scandinavia, like the Finns and the Dutch racing drivers and Swedish racing drivers, you go to Latin America. We've had Argentinians, we've had Colombians, we've had Brazilians, we've had Mexicans. They all come to England. We have Australians and New Zealanders have won world championships, and they all came over to Europe to cut their teeth in the most competitive formulas before they got to Formula One. So for us to have a top Formula One driver, we need them to sacrifice a lot of their youth, you know, getting away from their parents. You know, Lawrence Stroll's son is coming into Formula One, and he's a Canadian, and he'll be driving this incoming season with Williams.
Right.
Now, he's devoted himself to having to live in England, be educated in England or in Europe in order to get into as high as Formula One. And we would love to have more Americans. And yes, there could one day be another Detroit Grand Prix for Formula One cars. If there was a top American driver, there would be a desire to have an American Grand Prix in a much stronger sense than if there wasn't. When Mario Andretti was winning world championships, I was doing television with Jim McKay in Wide World of Sports. That year I did 25 different shows, not all Formula One, but the number was made up because of doing additional Formula One Grand Prix races because Mario Andretti was winning races and the American public wanted to hear and see it.
Did Alexander Rossi make a mistake by coming back to the United States when he couldn't get a ride?
Who?
Alexander Rossi was with Manor, I believe. Did he make a mistake by coming back and driving IndyCar? I know he won the Indy 500, but once you're out of the loop in F1, how hard is it to get back in?
Very difficult. You've got to prove yourself. If you're quick enough, you get it. I would love to have had Dario Franchitti drive a Formula One car, but he wasn't given the best opportunity when he did get one test drive for a Formula One team, and yet he won Indianapolis three times. You know, Emerson Fittipaldi finished his Formula One career and then went on to win Indianapolis. You've got all sorts of... Danny Sullivan won Indianapolis and was in Formula One. There's a lot of guys have, when they either past their best in Formula One, gone over to Indy and done very well. You can't race in America and expect to be a world champion without having to come to Europe against the competition of every damned country in the world. You know, you're running against the very best. They've won in club racing and national racing in their own country, then they've gone to their own continent to be the head of all of our American, if you like, South Americans. And whether you talk about Montoya, or you talk about Fangio, you talk about Fittipaldi and Pache, and we've got Venezuelans, we've got Colombians, we've got Brazilians, we've got Argentinians, They've all had to come to England to make it, or in Europe, rather, to make it. And that's what you've got to do. That's where Vettel's come from. That's where Magnussen's come from. That's where the Australians have come from, like Mark Webber. And actually, he just left me at my house here when the phone call came through. He
was
here for a few minutes. But, you know, all of these drivers, Magnussen right now, he's been through it. He's a Dutchman. And his father's Dutch, raced for my racing team. He was actually born in Belgium, but he's been living in Holland. He had to go through that whole procedure of the formative classes before he could get to the real big time. And Mario Andretti's son, for example, came over, but hadn't gone through the tough school.
I remember when Michael tried it, yeah.
And it obviously didn't work for him. But we would love to have an American in Formula One. It would be a good thing for Formula One Grand Prix racing. It would raise the crowds. It would raise the television interest. It would be great.
Would Mark Donohue have been that driver if he hadn't passed? Would he have been that guy?
He could have been. He might have raced a little too long in America before coming into Formula One, because he only came into Formula One because Roger Penske created a team. But he would have been more successful in Formula One and European racing had he come over to Europe earlier. It's not a question of coming to United Kingdom or England or France or Germany. You do the whole series, and it's a fantastic builder of people.
So, Sir Jackie, if it's 1973 and you need a teammate and it has to be a driver from today, who would you take?
I would have Magnussen, Verstappen. I would have Verstappen, and I would probably take the Australian, Ricciardo. I think Vettel's fantastic. Alonso's very good, but they're both have already achieved a great deal. I would need my team hungry, ambitious, with a huge amount of natural talent, which both of those boys have, and they've got good heads in their shoulders as well.
Do you feel like a lot of people that the rule change for next year in F1, the widened tires, the more downforce, is playing right in to Red Bull because of their design team being second to none?
Well, Adrian Newey is the main designer. But Adrian's getting tired as well. He's been in it a long time. There needs to be a successor to Adrian because he's already wanting to look at yachts and do all sorts of things. But he's still very good. But the Renault engine will be better this year than it was last year. So Mercedes is going to be, I hope, more challenged next year. But Adrian Newey will burn out. Now, I want an Adrian Newey for Race Against Dementia. But I want the Adrian Newey when he was 32. Adrian Newey's raced hugely successfully since around that age, designed some of the best cars in the world, won more world championships than anyone else, and he's now in his early 50s, and he's burned out. Not completely, but beginning to be burned out. I want an Adrian Newey, a young Adrian Newey in the pharmaceutical industry or in the medical industry that's going to find a cure and a preventive medicine for dementia, because most of the professors that I'm talking to right now are in their late 60s or up to middle 70s, but they're not burned out.
They've still got that fire.
Well, they might not have that fire.
Mm.
And that's why there's you reach a level, and then from that level there's a plateau, and you don't often learn a lot after that. I need to get somebody who's bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, hugely ambitious, with high energy, and they will burn out before the current generation of experts will burn out in medicine.
No problems, only solutions, right? No problems, just only solutions, and we need to have the right people that are looking for that solution.
Correct.
Sir Jackie Stewart, RaceAgainstDementia.com is the website. I've said this multiple times, and I've told friends it is so easy to contribute to this. And I know that with you behind it, not only do I know the money's going in the right place, but I know people are being held accountable for what they do with the funds. And that is just as important.
Well, we need the money to get the talent, because we've got to find that talent, whether it's in America, whether it's in Sri Lanka or China, I don't care. We've got to get that young talent. That's what we need the money for. And then we'd bring them to Europe, give them the best mental institution that we can find. And there's good ones in America, whether it's Harvard or whether it's a lot of others. But I think I know what I want, and I hope I'm going to be able to do it in my lifetime.
It's an honor speaking to you, sir, and thank you for everything you've done over the years and continue to do today. This was an absolute pleasure. It was a great Christmas gift for me, and I appreciate the time. Merry Christmas to you and Lady Helen and all your friends and family in the UK. We appreciate everything you do.
Well, a big happy Christmas and a good new year to Detroit. I love your city. I'm very happy. Edsel Ford's a great friend of mine, and by the way, he's a trustee for Race Against Dementia.
I will mention that to him next time I see him. Sir Jackie, it's an honor. Thank you very much, and we'll stay in touch. Hopefully see you here at Belle Isle during the summer.
I hope so. All the best.
All right. Cheers. Thank you, sir.
Okay, all the best.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.